Radio.
This panel discussion on ethics and euthanasia is part of the ACU Voice series organised by Australian Catholic University. This June 2012 recording features Dr. Bernadette Tobin of the Plunkett Centre for Ethics, Dr. Philip Nitschke, Professor Margaret O'Connor and Father Frank Brennan.
This is a debate that's full of emotion. It's not settled, is how I'd put it. It's still contested, sometimes with very loud hailers. And, you know, if I reflect, I've been interviewing on it in or around this subject on Life Matters since very much the early 90s, let alone Compass. And it's been very interesting over the years to watch the way the arguments have moved and changed, shape-shifted a bit. And I've watched people assemble their arguments for better or for worse. And I must say I have been more impressed with people who seem to believe there are no absolutes in this area, this process of suffering and dying. There's always room for moral nuance and conscience of the personal and of the church variety. Paul Collins, I fished out an article that he wrote in the old hard copy version of Eureka Street many years ago, and I remembered it. I've never forgotten it. I know I've put it somewhere in some, you know, archive at home, but I fished it out today, courtesy of the net. Paul Collins, of course, now a commentator. I think he was a priest then when he wrote this article. But he insists this is core business for the church and its moral tradition. And this is what he quoted Pope Pius XII. From this, the Pope speaks in 1958, and he just was quite simply put. Normally, this is the Pope speaking, normally one is held to use only ordinary means, according to circumstance of places, times and culture, means that do not involve any grave burden for oneself or others in terms of times around death. And this from a man who was himself to die just 6 months after making what I think was a very humane and realistic statement. The Catholic moral tradition, as Paul the historian judged then, has always valued life, but it's not afraid of death. So if he's right, if that distillation is right, does this have a constructive role to play in our current discussions, which are virtually a half a century on? So hopefully we'll tease that out tonight with our special guests, Dr. Bernadette Tobin, Dr. Philip Nitschke, Dr. Fran McInerney and Father Frank Brennan. I wonder if you'd give them a big welcome, please. But could I ask you first to welcome the Vice-Chancellor of ACU, Professor Greg Craven, who couldn't be with us last time. He was a bit ill, I think. He suddenly took ill. But he's here tonight for an official welcome.
Thank you very much, Geraldine. Can I welcome everybody here, our speakers, members of the university community, members of the public, those who are interested in the topic. I'll begin by saying what I'm sure you're all hoping to hear from a Vice-Chancellor, which is that I will be extremely brief. Universities, by definition, are places of intellectualism and by reality should be places of public intellectualism, and public intellectualism requires debate. It's the role of universities to debate, it's the role of universities to foster debate, and it's the role of universities to host debate. For there to be debate, there have to be differing points of views and people with those views to put them. And so on an issue like this, which as Geraldine says is live and fighting, it is entirely appropriate that a university such as the Australian Catholic University hosts a debate where strong views may be put. Because without strong views, there are no debate. And I say that unapologetically as someone who has the strongest possible view on this particular topic, and I'll leave you to guess what that is, from a university that institutionally has the strongest possible view on this particular topic, and I'll leave you to forget what that is. May I say it's wonderful to see you all here. The fact that there are so many of you here reminds me of the fact that in terms of this university, one thing you may not realise is that not only is it the fastest growing university in Australia, but next year becomes the largest English-speaking Catholic university in the world. which may be very good or very bad news, depending upon your view of particular topics, which may or may not be related to the subject of tonight's debate. This is part of the ACU Voice Lecture Series, as Geraldine has said. That correlates with a growing reputation and capacity in research, which follows the university's growth, so that we're very, very glad to have you all here today. I hope it's a most enjoyable debate, and I hope it's an enlightening debate in every possible way. So thank you very much for coming.
Well, now we're going to hear from Bernadette for about 20 minutes and then have each of our responders have 6 minutes to respond. So I'd like to introduce you now to Dr. Tobin. She's director of the Plunkett Centre for Ethics at St. Vincent's here in Sydney. She's a reader in philosophy at the ACU. She's conjoined associate professor at the School of Medicine at the University of New South Wales and at the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Sydney, and honorary ethicist at the Children's Hospital at Westmead. She has long been on the Australian Health Ethics Committee, a principal committee of the NH and MRC, and she also chaired the drafting group which prepared the first code of ethics for Catholic health and aged care services in Australia. So I can't really think of a better qualified person to address us now on euthanasia and its ethics. Dr. Tobin.
Geraldine, thank you. And it's an honour to have been asked to speak. I'm going to say a little bit about ethics. I'm going to say a little bit about dying, and I'm going to say a little bit about euthanasia. So about ethics. A doctor recently said of ethics, either you believe there's a God who tells you what's right or wrong, or it's all arbitrary. So it's worth saying a few preliminary words about what we're doing when we're doing ethics. Some people will say that moral beliefs and judgments are social conventions, what's right for us or wrong for us. They point to widespread difference in the beliefs and practices of particular societies. Ancient Greek infanticide, Laplander abandonment of their elderly, today's honour killings of women in India and Pakistan. And they point out how moral beliefs and practices change over time within the same society. The rejection of slavery in America, the rejection of our past view of Aborigines as inferior people. But the problems with cultural relativism are legion. To name three, the agreements between the moral beliefs and practices of societies are at least as significant as the differences. Cultural relativism seems to say there are no grounds for arguing against the perceived evils in our own society, as well as in other societies, that morality is just the majority view. And cultural relativists seem to contradict themselves when they say that we should tolerate moral differences between societies, but that sounds as though they're treating tolerance as a universal. Others think that moral beliefs and judgments are just expressions of the individual's feelings, preferences, attitudes, likes and dislikes. But though morality can be associated with strong feelings, this subjectivist view runs into the problem that it too seems to suggest that there are no grounds for rational argument about moral matters, that there's no room for the idea that anyone could be wrong or mistaken in their moral beliefs and judgments. It seems to make morality no more than a matter of taste, when in fact we often query the justification for moral beliefs, our own and others. We often treat them as something quite different from blind responses. So in what follows, I'll assume a different view of morality and ethics. I'll assume that moral beliefs and judgments are the products of our thinking about our experience of what's worth our attention, that they're the product of our rational reflection on what's worth our care and respect, what's worth desiring or having or doing or being. So I'm going to be objectivist about morality, and I'm going to treat moral beliefs and judgments as beliefs and judgments for which we can give reasons and about which we can be mistaken. This, of course, raises the pressing question of how to reason in ethics. And greatly oversimplifying, there are two schools of thought here. One says that we should start from people's feelings, preferences, desires, and work out how to satisfy as many of them as we can. We should do whatever will maximise preference satisfaction. Maximisers or consequentialists think that outcomes, results, consequences are all that matter. No choice is right or wrong in itself. It's only right or wrong insofar as it does or fails to maximise the satisfaction of people's preferences. The other school of thought says that we can recognise that and explain why some choices are right or wrong in themselves, no matter their consequences. Being faithful to a friend, being kind to a stranger, acting with fairness to the people one encounters in life, lying to the pesky patient, torturing the enemy combatant, framing an innocent man. All these choices have moral status independently of their consequences. On this view, consequences matter, but they're not all that matter. In what follows, I'll assume that the second is the better way to reason well in ethics. Let me say now a word about dying. As far as we know, many people die well. Some die in their sleep, some die free of pain and discomfort, free from anxiety and fear, in the company of those they love, having settled their affairs, even if they grieve, having reached the end of the narrative, which is their lives. And we know some people die badly, in pain and or discomfort, without the benefits of good medicine. We heard a story tonight which illustrated that. Lonely, uncared for, with unresolved hostility or resentment to a family member or friend or colleague, feeling a burden on others, fearful that their life amounted to nothing much, that they could have lived it better, etc. We know that there are barriers to people dying well. Doctors who've never been educated that the care of the dying is a central part of the Hippocratic commitment in the 21st century. Doctors have been taught that it's their business to prolong life at any cost. Doctors who are reluctant and hesitant about giving full effect to requests to withhold specified treatment, to withhold any and all treatments. Doctors who've been taught that it's a failure to think that respecting these perfectly reasonable expressions of individual autonomy is tantamount to deliberately causing the patient's death. And we know there are barriers to the treatment of pain, the stigmatisation of people with pain, the absence of data on pain, the costs of treatment, the lack of medical and nursing education in how to treat chronic pain, etc., etc. We know that a key idea in that is that chronic pain is a disease itself and that doctors need to be trained to relieve pain at least as well as our vets. And we understand why in 2011 the World Medical Association resolved that people facing pain have a right to appropriate pain management. Well, let me come now to euthanasia. Euthanasia is a word that belongs to the rhetoric of persuasion. It has no generally accepted and philosophically warranted core of meaning. The Dutch use it in one way, Nazi discourse used it in another, and it's used in a variety of ways in pluralist democratic societies. So I need to tell you how I use the word. I will treat the following case, the following as the central case of euthanasia, the adopting and carrying out of a proposal that, as part of the medical care being given to someone, his or her life be terminated on the ground that it would be better for him or her or at least no harm, if that were done. I'll ask you to indulge me while I repeat it. The central case of euthanasia, as I use that term, is the adopting and carrying out of a proposal that, as part of medical care being given to someone, his or her life be terminated on the ground that it would be better for him or her, or at least no harm, if that were done. This explanation encompasses employing deliberate omissions in order to terminate life, sometimes called passive euthanasia, and employing deliberate interventions for the same purpose, sometimes called active euthanasia. On this view, euthanasia can be voluntary, killing at the request of the person killed, non-voluntary, where the person killed is not capable of either making or refusing such a request, or involuntary, where the person killed is capable of making such a request but hasn't done so. This explanation of euthanasia distinguishes in a straightforward way, on the one hand, choosing to kill someone with drugs to relieve the person of pain and suffering, and on the other, choosing to relieve someone of their pain and suffering by giving drugs in a dosage determined by the drug's capacity for relief of pain and suffering, foreseeing that the drugs in that dosage will cause death. According to my usage, the former is euthanasia, the latter is not. Now, what I'd like to give you is an argument against legalising euthanasia and assisted suicide. The argument proceeds in two steps. The first points out something about the thinking involved in assisting someone to commit suicide or undertaking euthanasia. The second points out something about the significance of that thinking for the weak, the disabled, the vulnerable. The first part shows what's wrong with assisting someone to commit suicide or undertaking euthanasia. The second part shows the public policy implications of that thinking. I'll set the steps out and then I'll elaborate them. Step one. If one is really exercising autonomy and not merely yielding to impulse or compulsion in choosing to kill oneself or be deliberately killed, one will be proceeding on the basis of one or both of two judgments. One, that human life in certain conditions or circumstances retains no intrinsic value or dignity, and or that the world would be a better place if one's life were intentionally terminated. Both are mistaken. Second step, these judgments, being inherently universal, have grave implications for the weak and the disabled. These judgments, being inherently universal, have grave implications for the weak and the disabled. Let me elaborate. In 1994, a select committee of the English House of Lords rejected the legalisation of euthanasia. It said, society's prohibition of intentional killing is the cornerstone of law and social relationships. It protects each of us impartially, embodying the belief that all are equal. We don't wish that protection to be diminished, and we therefore recommend there be no change in the law to permit euthanasia. Embodying the belief that all are equal. Who's the all? People. Us, including the vulnerable and the disadvantaged. Equal in what respect, and thus why entitled to be treated as equal? What do we have in common? Our humanity. This isn't an abstraction. It's not Kant's thin, rationalistic reduction of our humanity to that aspect of our nature that we don't share with other terrestrial creatures, our reason and will. Rather, it's the capacity to live the life, not of a carrot or a cat, but of a human being. The capacity to deliberate and choose and shape things by one's choices. This capacity is human through and through. Reason and will are not simple add-ons to mere animal capacities. The capacity to deliberate and choose and shape things qualifies and transforms those other capacities in making human experience what it is. And every living human being has this radical capacity. Note that it's a capacity that's more or less actualized in various states of existence: walking, sleeping, traumatic unconsciousness, decrepitude, etc. It's a capacity for human awareness, feelings, imagination, memory, responsiveness and sexuality, wondering, relating, imagining, communicating, etc. In short, every human being is equal precisely in having a human life, which is our common humanity, our personhood, our dignity, our intrinsic value. In the life of a person in an irreversible coma or an irreversibly unresponsive state, the dignity of the human life is inadequately instantiated. Nonetheless, respect for human persons requires that one make no choice that violates the value by terminating that life. Now, of course, a fair-minded person may be unwilling to impose on themselves or their families or their communities the burden of expense involved in medical treatment. To preserve solidarity with them, the care to be provided to them need not be more than is provided to anyone and everyone for whom we have responsibility. The food, the water, and the cleaning that one can provide them at home. To do less could scarcely be understood in any other way than as manifesting a choice, even a choice made in advance by the patient himself, to proceed on the basis that such patients or anyone who is responsible for caring for them would be better off if they were dead. Such a choice would deny the person their equality of value and worth. This is not to say that their autonomy counts for nothing. Where one does not know that their requests are suicidal in intent, one can give full effect to requests to withhold specified treatment, to withhold any and all treatment, even when one considers the requests misguided or regrettable. One is entitled to, and one ought to, respect their autonomy and can reasonably accept their death as a side effect of so doing. But suicide and requests which one understands to be requests for assistance in suicide are very different. If a person is really exercising autonomy in choosing to kill himself or in seeking assistance to do so, or in asking another to do so, he will be proceeding on one or both of the two philosophically and morally mistaken judgments I mentioned earlier. Each is erroneous. The more important point is, for the law, each has grave implications for people who are in poor shape or whose existence creates serious burdens for others. Other writers have made this point in another way. I'll leave that for the discussion. Now, there are, I think, three serious objections that can be put to the argument that I have just laid out for you against legalising euthanasia or assisted suicide. I will just mention them and let you know that I think they can be answered. The first objection is, what about respect for autonomy? Surely this argument fails to respect the autonomy of those who wish to have their lives deliberately terminated. The second objection is, this view surely lacks compassion for those who suffer as they die. And the third objection is, this view fails to take account of the fact that legalising, assisting a person to commit suicide and undertaking euthanasia would both be consistent with our present practices in the care of the sick and the dying. those. I think the three objections that can be put to the position I've put to you tonight, I think each of them can be answered.
Well, thank you, Bernadette, very much indeed. It's a very interesting and good overview of your position, and it'll be fascinating to see how the discussion does proceed. So our first responder tonight is Dr. Philip Nitschke, who is the founder and director of Exit International, who I think, of course, is very well known as taking a very strong position. He became in 1996 the first physician in the world to administer a legal, lethal, voluntary injection under what turned out to be a short-lived Rights of the Terminally Ill Act of the Territory. Four of Philip's terminally ill patients used this law to end their lives before it was overturned by the Australian Parliament the following year. Philip, I didn't know this, was born in rural South Australia. He studied physics at the University of Adelaide. He did a doctorate at Flinders University in laser physics, but he rejected the sciences and travelled to the Territory to take up work with the Aboriginal land rights activist Vincent Lingiari and the Gurindji at Wave Hill. He became a Territory Parks and Wildlife Ranger. Then he had a serious accident to his foot, which saw him return to university. He graduated from Sydney University Medical School in 1988, and in a sense, I suppose, the rest is history. He's been nominated multiple times for Australian of the Year and widely holds public meetings, conducting exit workshops, and I think has maintained a very strong presence. So would you please welcome Dr. Philip Nitschke.
Thank you, Geraldine, for that introduction. Look, I'll be blunt about it. On the 22nd of September in 1996, after the law in the Northern Territory changed, I went around to Bob Dent's house on that hot Sunday afternoon and I killed him. This was a man who was suffering badly from the cancer, the prostate cancer that ravaged his body. He saw himself as being a person who was in the right place at the right time. He was living at a time when the law, for the first time, enabled a doctor like myself to come around and do what I thought was the compassionate thing, acquiesce to his request to have a peaceful death. It's a difficult thing, I'm sure you can understand just how hard it is to go to someone's place knowing that by the time you finished at that person's place, someone you'd got to know and like, that they will be dead. But it did seem to me that since I'd worked so hard along with the political process to bring in this legislation, that now in a sense it was crunch time to show that such a change was in fact a civilising improvement to the society we had. So I went around there, he said come for lunch, I had lunch with him, at the end he said let's do it. I went into the room, I put the cannula in his arm, I loaded a machine that I had built with the drugs, he pressed the button on the laptop computer which was part of the machine, and when he was confronted with a very blunt question which said, if you press this button you will die, he pressed the button, the drugs flowed, he pushed the machine to the side, he held his wife in his arms, and he died while Judy Dent, his wife, was holding him. I was sitting there on the other side of the room, watching this death take place, and the overwhelming feeling that went through my mind, and people often say, well, what did you feel, did you, or were you aware that you were breaking, or at least confronting some fundamental prohibition here in human behaviour, the overwhelming feeling that went through my mind was one of relief. The relief that the machine had worked and that took away some of the stress and the difficulty that I found in that process. Now, as Geraldine said, that law only lasted for a short time, four months, four of my patients ended up having peaceful deaths. They used the machine, they died peacefully, and the law was overturned by the Federal Parliament here in Canberra. And to my mind, we went back to the Dark Ages, a situation that was outlined earlier when Gideon on the video talked to us about the situation where he was confronted with when his father was so sick. With laws that say that suicide is not a crime, if you can go home and do it yourself, you don't break any law, but heaven help anyone who might come along and assist you in any way. They're the people who might spend, at least in Queensland and Western Australia, the rest of their lives in prison, and in the relatively civilised state of New South Wales, perhaps only 12 years in Long Bay, for assisting someone to take that lawful step. Now, looking back over that time, looking back at that experience with Bob Dent, did I do the right thing and did I do the lawful thing? Because this is a question, this is a discussion tonight about ethics. Did I do the lawful thing? Yes, I did. Of course it was. The law had changed. It was the lawful thing. If I did it tomorrow, it would not be lawful. But did I do the right thing? Because that's the important question. And to my mind, of course, there is no issue here. Of course I did the right thing. Now, we've heard... sorry about this cold. We've heard from Dr. Tobin, who said when she was discussing ethics, she said, look, she started with the very comment, you either believe there's a God, or it's all arbitrary. It puts atheists like myself into a somewhat difficult position. I guess it's all arbitrary for us, but I had no difficulty in working out what was the right thing. She went on to talk about medicine. She went on to say that, well, relief of pain. Doctors aren't trained about the relief of pain. With better training, better acceptance of this issue and dealing with this issue, we'll see the request for someone's help to die evaporate. But that wasn't always the case with these people that came to me in Darwin. Valerie, the last woman who came to Darwin to die of breast cancer, was a triumph of palliative care. She had the best palliative care in Sydney. She flew to Darwin. I said, what's the problem? You're dying of breast cancer, but are there symptoms? She said, no. I used to have pain. I used to have nausea. I used to have itching. And the best palliative care doctors in Sydney have resolved all that. And I said, hell, why are you coming to Darwin to die? She said, because I don't like what I've got like this. I don't like living like this, waiting to die. It's my time, and I want to take that choice. That's not just a matter of pain relief. It's not just a matter of teaching doctors how to deal with pain, and no one will ask. Few people will perhaps ask, but those who do, I think, need to be accorded the respect to end their lives in this way. So I'm going to finish on that point. I think that we've gone back into the dark ages, and I think that we've got to be able to accept the fact that the world is changing. It's all very well to quote from the House of Lords and say how they came out saying that this is an unwelcome development and we can't have this fundamental change, but there are plenty of other eminent bodies looking at this issue now. And we haven't, of course, referred to the recent one in Canada, which has come out with a totally different opinion. We won't be sitting here in a forum like this in 10 years' time, arguing this case. We're changing, the world's changing, and we need to accept it, I think, and move on to a more civilised society. Thank you.
Well, let's hear how Dr. Fran McInerney feels about things now. She's a registered nurse and sociologist. She holds postgraduate qualifications in nursing, education, social science and public health. She's very interested in research sense and dementia care, in social constructions of death and dying, in palliative context, requested death and the media. And she's been engaged in clinical practice and education research in these areas for the last 20 years. She's been a co-investigator or chief investigator on multiple internal and external competitive research grants and most recently was an invited scholar at the Free University of Brussels in recognition of her work in these areas of social responses to death and dying. So, Fran McInerney, you have 6 minutes.
Thank you, Jim. For those of you who were looking for Margaret O'Connor, I'm obviously not her, but she's okay, but she couldn't be here tonight. Couple of things, and obviously we're not going to solve these issues tonight, and maybe in 10 years' time, Philip, maybe in 95, it was in 10 years' time as well, maybe not in 10 years' time. Who knows? These are complex, momentous issues, I think. Just a couple of comments on Dr. Tobin's opening comments. I need to say I'm not an ethicist. I'm a nurse and I've worked in palliative care and aged care for a long time. And I understand that moral judgments are not just expressions of individual feeling or cultural convention, but also that they're not the products of purely rational processes for me. I think that as human beings we are an amalgam of the rational and the feeling of reason and passion. And I think that for me, in deciding what is right and wrong, I bring the fullness of that human experience, those feelings and those thoughts, and those cultural understandings to bear on my decisions. And I'm not talking about an endless moral relativism, but I don't think that we're just rational. And I think that practical contexts render moral decisions difficult, very difficult. I did also want to comment on the videos we saw earlier. A couple of things. The notion of polls and public support and policy being driven by the large public support for euthanasia. Interestingly, in the mid-90s, when the Rotey Act was in force, not only were about 70%+ of people in favour of euthanasia, over 70% of people were also in favour of capital punishment. And oddly enough, there weren't, and happily from my perspective, there weren't too many people trumpeting about bringing in capital punishment again. Polls are problematic, their framing's problematic, and using them as public policy drivers is likewise problematic. And they change. About 35% of people are in favour of capital punishment now. So who knows? I really wanted to comment on Gideon's story. The fact that Gideon's father, as I heard that video, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Gideon's father was asking if he would be alone at death, and his palliative care physician, who I'm really frightened I know, abandoned him on the spot, abandoned an engagement with whatever conversation that man was trying to forge, if we can believe that recount. And I'm not saying the lad was lying, but we reframe things, we re-story. But if that's what happened, I'm furious and ashamed to be part of a palliative care community that might abandon someone in that way. And if that is indeed what happened, and I fear it might be, it's no blessed wonder that people seek extraordinary measures like being killed if they're abandoned by the very people who are put there to help them through what is an arduous journey. So to say, I would agree with Bernadette that developing skills in people who you'd hope had the skills is fundamental. If we're going to trumpet autonomy and choice in the name of euthanasia, by jingo, it want to be a real choice for me. It would want to be an option among options. In our wealthy world here in Australia, about 23% of people who might benefit from palliative care get access. And I understand that Philip's last client who requested death was a star of palliative care. The vast majority of people don't even get that access. I'm not talking about it being compulsory, i.e. going through palliative care, but by goodness, if we're celebrating choice, let's make it a real choice, if that's what we're about, if autonomy is some ultimate good. I do get passionate, and that probably means I'm not very ethical, but I'm not going to apologise for that. I believe that we're all here to do the best we can. I think we're all ethical beings striving for the right thing to do, the best thing to do in what are messy, messy circumstances. For me, death as therapy, death as a good, just runs counter to my soul. And I know that is a misguided and limited way of considering our options along everybody's journey to death. Just to touch very briefly on my experience in Brussels, they were a great bunch of people, the Free University of Brussels. They celebrate their contribution to the legalisation of euthanasia. Oddly enough, they embrace me, who is deeply sceptical of the good of requested death. They're highly objective souls. I'm not sure how ethical they are, but they're highly objective. And they tell stories without too much of a blink about palliative care services being reduced by 30% in the last 12 months because of fiscal pressures in Europe. And that's because it's an expensive option. It's not an expensive option in comparison to acute care interventions. I leave it to your imagination to think about what it's expensive in relation to. And as a part of an ongoing debate in Belgium, the Parliament is currently exploring options to extend requested death to children under 18, as is the case in the Netherlands, and to those with reduced cognitive capacity. Now, I don't know about you, and I know it's an old story, slippery slope. This is actually legislative creep, to put it in another way. It's what Philip would probably call progress. Society changes in response to what becomes a cultural norm. That is a social fact. And for death to be a good and for struggle to be a bad, I fear for those, as Bernadette's mentioned, who are vulnerable, who are the least autonomous amongst us, who find themselves in extremis because they can't negotiate care with an unthinking clinician, and that they're forced into the caring arms of someone who might see death as a solution to their problems. And for me, that is just a failure of our humanity. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Fran. Love people with passion. Never apologise for that. Frank Brennan, I think, has a fair few passions too, heavily wrapped up in the lawyerly front. He's, as I think many of us know, worked tirelessly for human rights over 30 years. The founding director of UNIA, Jesuit Social Justice Centre in Sydney, and a visiting a professor of law here at the ACU, visiting professorial fellow at the University of New South Wales. Frank, over to you.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Good to be with you. Last Sunday after Mass, a young woman came up to me and she said, "Father, I really like your homilies, but I think you're slippery and not committed." And I think she was saying that she thought I was Jesuitical. So I'd like to compliment those who put the videos together. I found both the stories of Gideon and Nicholas quite compelling, and I think that highlights the difficulty about this debate and the difficulty we'll have in this debate for the next 10 years. I don't think I've ever done this before, but I'd particularly like to commend Philip Nitschke for fronting up to an audience like this and to a panel like this. I think last time we were together, Philip, you were playing to the home crowd and you were there with Bob Brown and Peter Boehm. I was with Tony Abbott and Maria Cicolini. So maybe we're evening it up. But I think in terms of the public discourse about ethics in a country like Australia, issues of autonomy and non-discrimination, they resonate very strongly with everybody. But the thing is, they're not trumps. And there are issues about the culture we want to create. There are issues about the common good, what we would call about what's necessary for the natural human flourishing for everybody. And so a lot of my take on this complex issue is still about trying to look at it through the eyes of the vulnerable. As Philip will recall, I played a role in getting that federal legislation up, in part putting the perspective of Aboriginal people who I'd heard from. One of my concerns about this debate in a society like Australia is that we are an ageing population. The Productivity Commission pointed out recently that those over 85 of us are presently 400,000. By 2050, it'll be 1.8 million people. And as all of us who have aged relatives know, some of those people suffer dementia. And there are going to be very critical questions about the treatment of those people and how do you ensure autonomous decisions are made. I concede there are problems with polls, but I want to quote two of them. One is the Canadian Environics poll that came out last year that found that 78% of people are concerned that the elderly might be euthanized without consent if it were to be the existing regime. And 63% thought that the elderly could be pressured. And it's those sorts of pressures, as Nicholas Tonti-Filippini was highlighting. I'd also like to refer to the ComRes poll of 2010 in the UK, where the disabled were questioned. And Admittedly, only 35% of them thought that there would be pressure placed on them individually to end their lives prematurely, but 70% thought there'd be pressure on other disabled people. And very significantly, 56% of them thought that it would be detrimental to the way that disabled people are viewed by society as a whole. So these are things that have to be in the mix in making these ethical decisions, as well as autonomy, non-discrimination in the individual case. Another thing which I think needs to be debated is the difference between euthanasia, however we define it, and physician-assisted suicide. I went to Oregon a year ago and I was surprised to see that they are insisting on that right-line solution. And I thought there would be far more people availing themselves of the service, but in fact in 1 year only 65 did. So even though it's said it's difficult to isolate the particular cases, then there may be more matters to discuss. The woman largely responsible as the social worker for the scheme there in Oregon told me that only 10% of people who avail themselves of the service were concerned about inadequate pain control. 96% were concerned about loss of autonomy, particularly if there might be the threat of dementia or whatever. The philosophical quandary for me is this, and it's not a religious one. Joseph Raz, one of the great jurisprudential thinkers who was at Oxford for many years, I don't agree with everything he says by any means, and he's very strongly in favour of euthanasia. But he gave a lecture at Oxford a month ago where he said, look, this argument about just having a narrow view of euthanasia, where it be just for cases of people who are suffering great pain or whatever, he says, philosophically, it doesn't wash. In the end, it's got to be just a step on the way to a broader notion of euthanasia, as he would put it, to protect not only the option to escape certain undesirable conditions at the end of one's life, but also and primarily to protect an option to shape the way one's life ends by deciding on its time and manner. And so it's a big question for society. Do we move from do no harm to saying yes, allow the administration of the lethal injection whenever it is requested by the autonomous self-determining individual, regardless of the effect that might have on the culture and particularly on those who are vulnerable? And I think that's the challenge for us. One final plea, if ever there were to be a law that permitted euthanasia, then it is essential that we don't go down the path we did in Victoria with abortion law reform to say that it would be compulsory for doctors, nurses, particular hospitals to provide the service. For God's sake, for our sake, let us ensure that religious people or those opposed to euthanasia can conduct their facilities where there is a respectful ethos for life, where they want to maintain that 6,000-year tradition of do no harm. Thank you.
Well, now, I would welcome questions now, and I would ask you, if you wouldn't mind identifying yourself and keeping them to a minute, please, so that we... I mean, I know this is a topic that, about which there are great passions, and fabulous, that's terrific, but if you wouldn't mind just exercising just a bit of discipline in that respect, I'd be grateful so that we can get as many through. And, of course, this is being recorded, too, for playing on Radio National, so you're on show. So, I mean, I'll fire away, but who would like to ask the first question? Yes, please, sir.
Hi, I'm Shradhir Rathor. I'm glad, Frank, that you mentioned about abortion. What I would like to say is that if anybody in our society support abortion, which is like, you know, stopping the life where all the life is ahead of you, then I can't understand by the logic of, you know, stopping people who have lived most of their good life and now they want to kill themselves with their own choice. So the comparison is very obvious that in one case, the person who is going to be killed doesn't have a choice, doesn't have a say, and we have all supported it and allowed it and made it legal. Then on the other hand, we want to make it illegal where the person has lived his life and make a conscious decision to end it.
So you don't think they're comparative at all, you're saying?
Well,
you think
I'm saying that we are being at loggerhead, that abortion, which is, you know, killing a future life.
With no choice.
We have accepted it and we support it. And, you know, if you support abortion, then you have to support it through euthanasia. Okay. Just, you know, as simple as that. Thank you.
Frank?
I don't think it's as simple as that, and it may be that you'd want to revisit the question of abortion. But basically, in philosophical terms, you wouldn't say that two wrongs make a right. But there are also other complex questions of abortion, particularly at a pre-viability phase, when you ask questions about the role of law in entering into the life domain of a woman making decisions about her body. Now, those questions are not germane, I don't think, in relation to euthanasia. So for that combination of reasons, I would distinguish out the two questions.
Bernadette?
I don't know if I made this point clearly enough, but let me try now. If you legalise euthanasia, in the sense that I expressed it, the part of the logic of the position is that you legalise the non-voluntary and the involuntary. They share the same judgment, and the judgment is this person would be better off dead, or death would be a good, or all up it would be no loss were this person to be dead. Now, when Dr. Nitschke says he acquiesced in the patient's request, the point is that the patient makes a request and the doctor then has to make a judgment. The doctor will acquiesce in the patient's judgment about his own life if he too makes that judgment about that patient's life. And if that's the case, then the doctor can make that judgment about someone's life who does not request euthanasia or help in assisting taking his own life. That's the central point that I'm trying to make, that the logic of legalising euthanasia in the voluntary case commits you to legalising it in the non-voluntary and the involuntary case.
Actually, that I was going to ask you, you had that phrase, that it is an inherently universal decision. I'm struggling with that.
Well, look, Geraldine, this is a point that comes from the philosopher Immanuel Kant, and he's the man who says that the essence of ethics and morality is respect for individual autonomy. But he makes this point, that when you respect me as a human being, you are respecting my reasoning, the logic of my position. And just as I can't make an exception for myself in the case of wanting to make a promise that I know I can't keep, if I'm going to say that's something I can do for myself, then I am committed to the view that anyone can make a promise that he knows he can't keep. That is to say, there's something inherently universal in the judgment. So if I make this judgment about my own life, and I find a doctor who will acquiesce in that judgment, he too will agree that my life isn't worth living. Here's my point. He doesn't need my request to make that judgment.
But if the law was structured in such a way, why wouldn't he? I mean, why couldn't that we structure, for the sake of argument, a law where it was quite plain that there was informed consent and versus somebody being compelled?
Well, some of the proponents of legalising euthanasia when it's voluntary not only understand that they are committed to legalising it when it's not voluntary, but they accept the logic of their own position. And it's one of the things that I admire Peter Singer for, that he is forthright about what the position commits him to. He's in favour of non-voluntary euthanasia. And it's admirable that he's not only bright enough to understand his own position, but he owns up to it.
Philip Nitschke, do you want to buy into this?
Well, look, I can see there is an issue here, and of course I support Peter Singer's position of the non-voluntary euthanasia case we're talking about, where he illustrates and uses as an example the severely disabled infant and the question about what should happen in that case. I found no difficulty in deciding whether or not I should acquiesce, and I see that word's been quoted back to me, in the case of the Bob Dent situation, Bob Dett came along and put his case to me in the sense I did make a judgment. I came along and imposed my template on what a life worth living is and isn't, put that onto Bob, put myself into Bob's position and thought, Jesus, if I was in that position, I'd want to die. I would not want to go on like that. So I made that decision, but I didn't feel comfortable with it. And again, referring back to Peter Singer, to be ethically consistent, I find myself increasingly these days stepping back and saying, it's not up to me to come along to people and say, I'll judge you. I'm the judge. I come along and I look, yes, you're sick enough. Okay, here are the drugs. No, you're not sick enough. You don't get the drugs. Increasingly, I'm of the opinion that if you're a rational adult, you should have the drugs. It's your decision. Adult people should have this choice. And in a sense, the law reflects it. Adult people can kill themselves. Suicide is no crime. But of course, to sit here on one hand and say that suicide is not a crime but you can't get assistance is to throw us out into a stupid world in which people can't get information. They do things in desperation. The commonest method the elderly use to kill themselves now is by hanging. And that's because they can't get information, they can't get drugs, and we don't have politicians with enough guts to change the situation.
My name's Josh Cohen and I'm a palliative care nurse. The word that keeps springing to my mind during this debate is the word reductionist. And to me, the whole, perhaps the healthcare conversations that we need to have around things like advanced care planning, especially with an ageing population where you have frail people, those conversations are hard, those conversations are avoided. We keep offering inappropriate interventions. We fail to put boundaries on things. And my feeling is that, and it was really, Dr. Nishki, when you spoke about the really vivid process that happened for this patient up in the Northern Territory, it was all about the computer and the button and the patient doing it. I found that reductionist. And I found your position in that intriguing. I didn't quite understand how that worked for you. But I wonder, does that word reductionist ring true with anyone else on the panel?
Well, Fran, because you haven't spoken yet.
Yeah, well, give me a go. yes, I'd have to agree with that. Another word, I suppose, that comes to my mind is, it's again reductionist. I don't want to get on a feminist soapbox here, but it's kind of, and particularly, you know, there are men in the room, but it's a masculinist curative predictable and controlled response to what is an unpredictable life journey, I suppose. And yeah, well, we all sigh and sighs thy soul away. You're curing a problem, and that's lovely. It's civilised, as you said on a number of occasions, and it's neat and it's clean, and it's not relational. I mean, your relief when at Bob Dent's death, I understand that. We often feel relief when someone dies for a variety of reasons. Your relief that the machine worked. I'm always relieved when a syringe driver does the job of relieving someone's symptoms. It's the clinical nature of what that encounter seems to be about that frightens me and disturbs me, and it's using a really heavy hammer to cure a problem of suffering by annihilating the person experiencing that suffering. And so I think that is a form of reduction. Yes,
Phil.
I mean, interesting comments. I mean, so this idea that concerned about, intrigued by my position with the machine, the questioner suggesting, or is it being suggested here, that we should put the doctor centre stage again? I mean, the machine got me out of centre stage. I did not want to be the person sitting there making the decisions, delivering the drugs, watching the person die at the end of the needle. The machine got me out of the place, out of that centre stage. It allowed his wife to come in, occupy that personal space, hold him in her arms, and he died in her arms. The machine was the feminist item. Getting doctors out of the whole dying process is important. Let's not assume that they should be there. Death is not a medical process, it's a natural process. Let's not medicalise it. The profession is very good at moving into areas where it has no domain. medical profession has done it since time began. They become the experts. In the case of the legislation in the Northern Territory, the profession, medical profession, did everything it could to make sure that law never passed. Having got it through, they then set themselves up as the gatekeepers with the key. We have to be suspicious about this. And the machine, I think, was liberating because it moved me away. It made it quite clear. We're not talking about some evil doctor with a moribund patient that's being put down, another Harold Shipman. We're talking about a patient who knows what they're doing, interacting with the screen and making the decision. The doctor is irrelevant.
But you brought the machine, though, didn't
you? Someone had to. And someone had to put the drugs in the machine. And let's not be naive, or Bob Dent would have hung himself.
I wasn't sure what you meant when you said it's reductionist. I wonder whether it was a comment about this discussion here. And although I was very happy to take part in this debate, I think it's a really important one for us. In many ways, I really hate it, because I think that there are so many more important things to investigate about how to ensure that people die as well as they can. Mm. And it's to do with really good pain relief. It's to do with really good attention to how people, the person wants to die, and whether they want religious symbols or not, and whether they want to be at home or not. It's to do with really good advanced care planning, and it's to do with appointing someone to speak with the doctors and the nurses like yourself. There's so much more that's really important and really interesting. But one of the things we have to face as a society is whether this is something that we should legalise or not. And as I say, in one sense, I don't think it gets to the heart of what we ought to be turning our attention to with respect to people dying well. But we have to face this question. And I think that, I want to say it with real respect for Philip, that what's not being noticed is that it's not just the judgment of the person, it involves the judgment of the doctor as well. And if the doctors can say it would be better that this person's life is terminated in this case, then the logic of that judgment is it can be made in cases where it's not asked for. And it's hard to get that across, but if some of the proponents of the legalisation of euthanasia can see that that's the logic of their case, and Philip can too. He says he's in favour of non-voluntary euthanasia, and he's given us an example. We really need to take seriously what Peter Singer and what Philip Nitschke say about their own position, because they see the logic of it.
Mm. Yes, Frank, before you...
Just going to say, I think there are a lot of pro-euthanasia advocates who are also very concerned about palliative care and see the importance of relationships. And I think what you're suggesting is the importance of the relationship of all persons with the person who is dying. And when you spoke, I was reminded of the case also that Philip was involved in a few years ago, the Christian Rossiter case in Western Australia. You might remember that, the man who went to court who wanted to be taken off hydration and nutrition. And the court said, yes, that's fine, that's a self-determining act. And we all expected he'd die soon after, but he didn't. And what happened? It turned out, as we read in the media, was that there was an outreach worker who established a relationship with him and got him to start recounting some of his life history. And yes, he ultimately died, but it was not an immediate result of saying, I'm going to see through that decision. Because in the complexity of human relationships, with the palliative care and the relationships that were there, he decided on another course.
Yes, please.
Hi, my name's Barbara. I'm a nurse too. And for Professor Tobin, she talks about value of life, and, I see quality of life as being, very important, and that quality is determined by the individual. And, what's quality to me might not be quality to you. And, I don't think voluntary euthanasia and palliative care are, poles apart. I think, for the majority of people I look after, they get good palliative care, and in no way do they want to end their own lives, and in no way are we pressuring them to do so, or the families or anybody else. But I think, you know, regardless of the palliative care you give to these people, if they have made a choice in a sane mind that they want to end their lives, I think it's very arrogant of us to say, well, you've got a quality of life and therefore, you know, you've no right to want to end that. And I really don't see how voluntary euthanasia becomes involuntary euthanasia. You know how, I mean, obviously the legislation would have to, you know, determine that we're very specific about people, you know, saying that they want to end their life and that we're not we're not in a position to make that decision. And also, I don't think it's for Philip to actually put himself in Mr. Dent's position. You know, if Mr. Dent says to you, my life has no quality and I want to end it, it's not for us to say, well, if I was in that position, would I end my life? It doesn't matter. It's his decision. And, yeah, I feel very strongly about that.
My name's Yvonne Spielman. I was a community worker in Darlinghurst quite some years ago. But it seems to me that palliative care may serve a very, very good purpose, particularly good palliative care. But there are an awful lot of people who don't get that palliative care. And their deaths are absolutely hideous. The other thing I would like, and I think that's really important to note, we don't have enough resources going into adequate palliative care. So whilst it's good, it's great. But if it's not there, it's an appalling way of living, dying. The other thing is, I don't think that the doctors should be too involved in euthanasia. I don't think it's a medical matter, really. I think it's a philosophical matter and an ethical matter. And they don't have to be. I mean, there are many ways of dealing with life and death situations.
But if people do need assistance, I think that's the question, then you need, the better, the more skilled, the better. And isn't that the dilemma?
No, it's not my dilemma. I mean, I think that people, certainly if they do need assistance should be available from medical practitioners and nurses and people such like. But I think it is not necessary to have doctors involved. After all, they have signed a pledge that they will maintain life. And it must be very, very difficult for them to take on board this whole concept of euthanasia.
That's what I've always found very interesting in this subject, that I think of all the... When I think over the years, I've usually reported on people who want extra rights and skills and duties. And the one area I find doctors generally, they say, no, don't give us this, which I've always found most provocative. Very, very thought-provoking as an issue. Now, would you like to go...
Well, I would. The point about the relationship between religion and ethics is a very important one, and I must have made it too briefly to have been understood. How I began was by quoting a doctor, a very well-educated man, who made a very silly remark about ethics. He said, either you think it all, either you believe in a God who tells you what to do, or it's all arbitrary. And then I said, so we need to think about what we're doing when we're doing ethics. Now, I suppose I should spell it out more. Of course, that is a false view that I reject. As it happens, I'm a cradle Catholic. And in Catholic Christianity, reason is not only part of our religious belief, it is that which controls how we understand even revelation. So when I explained in the ACU magazine the basis on which I would take part in this debate, I used the opportunity to explain why I would refer to nothing religious, that none of my arguments would be religious. Now, I'm sorry if I have been misunderstood, but I ask you now to hear what I'm saying and accept that that is a true account of the case I made tonight. You mightn't be persuaded by the case I made tonight. I don't expect you to be, but I do expect that you don't misrepresent the case that I made tonight.
I'm sorry about that.
Now, do anybody want to take up, especially the issue about, I suppose the issue this lady made about the arrogance of intervening in somebody's choice,
yes.
Which I suppose
yes.
was also related in a way to the lady up the back, sort of talking about not wishing to have doctors involved. I mean, Fran McInerney, I just...
I guess just a couple of things that are somewhat related to those questions. And, words are odious and they all have various loadings. And so when we were talking about reductionism before, I certainly wasn't demonising Philip. I think he is a good man and does his best. I may not agree with what he does. To compare you to Harold Shipman, that's just disingenuous and, you know, straw man approach, and that's silliness. He was a murderer and benefited financially and otherwise out of all sorts of nefarious activities. But in terms of the arrogance of responding to someone who might request death, and no one has ever requested death of me, and that may be because we work in a context where it's seen as verboten or for whatever reason. I don't know. I can't explain that. But the notion of arrogance, I would never respond to someone's expression of being tired of life, which I've certainly experienced, by dismissing that or not engaging with that. That kind of arrogance is not in my frame of reference.
No one's ever requested death, really.
No one's ever said,
so they've said, you know, I've had enough. Do they say that?
Yeah, they've said I've had enough.
But they don't go on and request,
no.
Really.
No, but again, I mean, who knows why that is? I've worked for, I'm sure there's all sorts of reasons, but I've worked for secular and Catholic palliative care facilities, but palliative care has a particular is understood in a particular way societally that may restrict people asking. I don't know. Maybe it's the cut of my jib. I don't know. I understand the arrogance. I take a point of Frank's that arrogance can also go both ways, and I think it's really important that this isn't something that's expected or demanded of another to take another person's life, and you know that's there are many fundamentals for me here, but that's certainly one of them.
Yeah. Frank, you.
To our humanist friend, I'd say I agree with Socrates. To those concerned about extending palliative care, I would say that I think this is one of the great challenges in terms of it would be a mistake for us as a society to take legalised euthanasia as being the cheap option rather than addressing broader questions of palliative care. Now, this is not an idle threat. It is one of the problems in Oregon where there, of course, people have to have their health insurance, and health insurers have been known to say to elderly people, look, we're not going to provide this suite of services because you do have available to you a cheaper option. Now, that is something which could creep into the society. Another thing I'd say, some will be shocked by it, but I think if we do have legal euthanasia, then I think we should set up a medical specialty of it so that we can isolate it from the rest of the medical profession who can continue to live by that simple mandate of do no harm, and that for those who would develop the specialty, presumably there would be all sorts of other training, including relationship training, etc., so that what might be done might, in inverted commas, be more humane than it might otherwise have been.
Philip, do you wish to...
Oh, look, I'm a bit concerned about that last suggestion, because the problem there, of course, is that it's still channeling it down the medical pathway. You don't have to... There's nothing intrinsically medical about this process. It's actually very easy. People need access to the right drugs. That's the problem. And the medical profession is used in the legislatures where it's possible to get help to die as the gatekeepers to that process. So they're basically administrators of a process to try and assess a patient, etc., decide who gets the nod and who doesn't. But realistically, there's no special skill needed. The person just has to have the right drugs. And this interaction with palliative care is interesting too. I mean, I would hate to see the idea suggested that in some ways palliative care is going to somehow or other lose out because this cheap option is now available. I mean, in the experience that I saw in the Territory, the big winner was palliative care. Everyone was falling over themselves, making sure that people had their palliative care options explained and made available. And people said, heavens, there's not a very well-developed palliative care service in the Northern Territory, but there is now. Because they were so fearful, the authorities said, we can't have people taking this option because they might be being channeled down that path. So palliative care wins pretty well out of these sorts of debates and arguments. So I'm a bit wary about this idea, as I said, of medicalising an issue which is intrinsically non-medical. And just in clarification, but I certainly wasn't in any way suggesting that people were likening me to Harold Shipman. I was simply trying to say that one good thing about the machine was that this was not a case of an evil doctor putting a moribund patient down like Harold Shipman. The machine made it quite clear.
Although your first words were, I went around and I killed him.
Of course I killed
him. You said that.
Well, let's not split terms. Of course I killed him. Harold Shipman murdered them.
I'm not talking about the Harold Shipman. It was just a very startling
oh, yes.
statement.
Oh, well, that was an attention-getting statement.
Yes.
Just on that expression, quality of life, it's a tricky expression. And I think one reason why it's tricky is that it can be understood in two different ways. In one way, even those of us who think that we shouldn't deliberately kill people can be absolutely committed to ensuring that they live as well as they can. Now, that's one understanding of that quality of life considerations really matter. No pain, no uncomfortable symptoms, no treatment that they refuse with people if they want them, turn towards Mecca, turned away, whatever. That's one sense of quality of life. But there is a different sense in which it's sometimes used where people mean that we can make judgments about the worth or value of a person's life. And it's part of my of the position that I was putting, that we can't do that. So they're two different senses of quality of life.
Yes, now that gentleman over there and then behind you. Yes.
Thank you. My name is Richard Mills. I'm president of Dying with Dignity in New South Wales. I'd like to comment on the suggestion that there's some inevitability between voluntary euthanasia, non-voluntary euthanasia and involuntary euthanasia when the evidence in the Netherlands and Belgium is that the incidence of non-voluntary euthanasia has decreased by about half since the legislation came in. I'd invite the
Yeah, look, could I respond to that? I think, Geraldine, that the evidence is controversial. You can find studies that will support one position and its contrary. So I think there's a real difficulty in making the claim that you have made. But the point that I was trying to make was not an empirical slippery slope from the voluntary to the non-voluntary to the involuntary. My point was that logically, if you think that euthanasia is permissible in circumstances where the patient asks for it, you're committed to the view that it's permissible in circumstances where the patient hasn't asked for it. That's the logic of your position. So that's what I'm trying to...
I understand the distinction you're making, Professor. I understand the distinction you're making. Can I just respond to that first question about evidence? I haven't seen evidence that contradicts that fact that I've seen, that the incidence of non-voluntary euthanasia has reduced by half. I haven't seen anything that...
Well, I mentioned just one thing. Netherlands is part of a number of countries where there's a move to widen the scope of euthanasia that's legal to the case of severely ill newborn babies. Nothing voluntary about that.
But can I ask again... Could I have the evidence
Well,
the evidence is a protocol called the Groningen. I may have mispronounced it. The Groningen protocol. But I really don't want to get into an argument about what the evidence says, because I just think it's controversial, the evidence, and almost any position can be backed up by some study or other.
I did notice, actually, there was quite an interesting new book debated in the Tablet. We do have to go, so I'm going to ask you to thank Dr. Bernadette Tobin, Dr. Philip Nitschke, Dr. Fran McInerney and Father Frank Brennan. And I'm going to ask Professor Greg Craven to close proceedings tonight. Thank you very much indeed for your time and very good questions, I think. Thank you.
Very, very, very briefly, thank you all very much for being here tonight. I have no idea whether anybody's mind has been changed in any direction, but I think everyone will agree that there has been a genuine discussion tonight on a very important issue, and that's not necessarily that common on this particular issue. So on behalf of all of you, I'd like to thank our participants, and I understand that there is a gift that is now going to be distributed to them. So there you are. And I think we also have a gift, do we not? Some flowers for Geraldine. So I'd ask you all to thank Geraldine. Bye.
You are listening to a panel discussion on ethics and euthanasia. To find out more about ACU Voice, visit acu.edu.au/ACU Voice. For more talks, interviews and programs, visit cradio.org.au.